Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm pleased to have as my guest Robert Pinsky, who's written the first book in a new series called the Jewish Encounter Series. This is The Life of David, and it's published by Schocken in their next book imprint. And it is both a life of David and a reading of the books of the Bible, Samuel 1, Samuel 2, Kings, Chronicles. So it's both literary history and history and poetry. It's a work of the imagination. Now, you were given your choice, I assume, of any topic. Why did you choose King David?
It was a brilliant suggestion by a brilliant editor named Jonathan Rosen. And I realized, in terms of your theme song, of all the human animals, this is the one, probably of all the legends and myths and actual lives, this is the one that's done the most different things. Who else was a great artist and a great killer? It just doesn't happen. And in addition to the books of the Bible and all the poems, there are these amazing legends. So I discovered a marvelous work of scholarship called The Legends of the Jews by Louis Ginsberg, containing crazy, elaborate, wonderful stories that have built up over many centuries over this most magnetic character, most extraordinary life ever lived or told.
Now, let's begin at the beginning. The people of Israel are calling for a king, and Samuel the prophet tells them that they'll be sorry, essentially.
Yeah.
God doesn't want there to be a king unless there absolutely has to be. If the people demand it, well then, all right. And he goes and anoints Saul as king. David is a kind of aid to King Saul. He plays and sings for him when Saul is undergoing the melancholies of being a king who already the kingdom is chafing under the presence of the king. And David is a man of peace, but when he begs to be allowed to go out to do battle with Goliath, he reveals himself to be a man of war as well. And so your book begins with a series of contradictions, complications, oppositions, that Saul is a king who is anointed, but not under a God who approves of kings.
The man who anoints him seems to hate the idea of a king. I read this as having a lot to do with the transition in the culture of these people who are telling this story. One of the cries that goes up often is, every man to his tents. And you're moving from a phase when these various loosely associated Hebrew tribes are moving from every man to his tents, when it's basically each family patriarch and a few religious leaders, to having a central government. And for Saul, who doesn't want to be king, he sort of tries to hide from it, he's immediately confronted with the fact that these people really don't, they're still every man to his tents. They're crazy Bedouins or mafia lords. They're warlords, and or a lot like warlords. And a crisis comes. There's one of these warlords of the non-Hebrews, Nahash, is besieging a city. And the city says, look, we'll make peace with you. Let's make a covenant. And Nahash says, okay, let's make a covenant, but I'm going to require that everybody in the city have their right eye gouged out, just as a sort of gesture of good faith and to show me that you're serious people. This causes consternation, and they ask for a little time. Nahash is a reasonable man. He gives them time. They go to the king, Saul. Saul was made king. A lot of people didn't give him the king presence. He wasn't considered so likely. And Saul shows he's not a bad choice for this awkward job. He sees the problem, and he deals with the problem by calling for a pair of oxen. And he takes out his sword, and he cuts up the oxen into lots and lots of bloody pieces. And then he has a few messengers go to what is called all the coasts of Israel, and they say to everybody they meet, this is what happens to the oxen of anybody who doesn't volunteer for the army to help King Saul fight Nahash. Turns out to be a very effective recruiting method. Irresistible to say, I don't see how you cannot say, this is like a mafia story or some story from a very violent place and time in which the leader says, I'm a serious man. I'll do anything. I will do anything I need to do. And people feel, better follow this guy, not only because they're afraid of him, but because they're impressed by his determination and his readiness to be quite brutal. And they get quite a good army, and they defeat the army of the Philistines of Nahash. It works. So Saul, to give poor Saul his credit, he's so eclipsed by David, Saul does create a very effective kingship by chopping up those oxen and sending the bloody parts of the oxen around the country.
And David, too, is beset by a set of contradictions. As a sweet singer, he's a boy, and he demonstrates that he can kill the giant Goliath, not expected, and he becomes doubled in his role as warrior and poet, as besieger and solacer, essentially, to the troubled spirit. And it's in that double role, it's as if that double role is the sign of his kingship.
It's kind of amazing that the story is told twice in ways that don't quite make sense together logically. One story is the story where David comes to prominence by playing the harp and soothing King Saul. And then in the other telling, Saul seems not to recognize his harp player. He says, who are you? Where do you come from? Who's your dad? Is it? And David says, Jesse. And in the other story, David is sent by his dad to deliver some cheeses to the serious brothers, the older brothers, who are fighting at the front. And we've already had the story of David as the little harper. In fact, we've already had the story where Samuel is looking over the sons of Jesse to pick a new king, and he sees one, he says, that must be the one. And it's Eliab, David's older brother, because he's a tall, big guy. And goes through all those brothers. David is out watching the sheep. In one legend, he's not even a full son. He's the son of an Egyptian slave girl. And these stories, in a way, contradict one another. They're all great stories. And in a way, they don't contradict one another. They make this figure who's everything. David, the beautiful boy. David, the dangerous brigand. David, the old man. David, the poet.
Now, in the book, you suggest that these doublings of stories and contradictions don't lessen the effectiveness or the message of the life, but rather make it more effective because of the fog through which David emerges, essentially.
The fog and the all-inclusiveness.
My guest is Robert Pinsky, and we're talking about The Life of David, the first book in the Jewish Encounters series, recently published and sponsored by Schocken Books. Well, what's interesting to me is that, as you point out, Saul dies, as does David's beloved friend Jonathan. The heads are displayed, and then David, responsible in part for the deaths, is also responsible for the elegy. killing and celebrating.
Extraordinary thing. He seems he's been the bodyguard of a Philistine king. He's been a henchman of a Philistine king for a good while. And he says he wants to go into that terrible battle in which Saul and Jonathan, David's very, very close friend, possibly his lover, they die along with Saul's other sons, several other sons. David says he wants to fight on the Philistine side in the battle. And his lord, Achish, says, yes, fight. And it's the other Philistine lord say, no, we don't trust him. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. What would David have done? Would he have betrayed his Philistine lord and turned out to fight for Saul and Jonathan after all? Would he have fought them? Did he know all along he wouldn't be allowed to fight in the battle? So he just said that. Maybe that's the best solution. Anyway, after the battle, he has a personal emotional problem. He has a political problem. And he writes one of the greatest poems I've ever read in the English translation. It's a great, great poem. And that poem, Tell It Not in Gath, Publish It Not in the Streets of Ascalon, How Are the Mighty Fallen, that poem, it sounds like you could have it at a ceremony along with brass bands and flags. And it also sounds like he's speaking entirely from his heart about people he knew and loved. It, to an amazing extent, that piece of writing fits his political purposes, fits a ceremonial occasion, and sounds utterly lyrical and personal.
Now, among the many signs of contradiction, Saul offers David, the victorious warrior, his daughter, but that daughter is given away to another man.
Yes.
Then a second daughter appears, who, in fact, a new idea, loves David.
Yes.
She helps him to escape because she learns that Saul's intention is to get rid of him.
Rub him out.
And even that daughter, the loving daughter, is given in marriage to another man. So the impact is that something is either tricky beyond belief or else incomprehensible.
These people are not us. The familiar names like Ruth and David and Saul and Jesse, they sound like you might meet them at a wedding. They behave very oddly. And I think they are us, but you have to recognize the strangeness and how alien and different a lot of things are before you can recognize the human motives. In that first scene when Saul says to David, I like you, kid. I want you to marry my oldest daughter, Merab. And it says quite explicitly, David is thinking, I hope you die. And David isn't fooled. And David also knows this guy wants me to die. And David says, oh, who am I, Lord, to be a king's son-in-law? I'm just a poor shepherd boy. And Saul says, no, I like you, I like you. Look, you don't have to pay me a fancy bride price for Merab. Just bring me the foreskins of 100 Philistines.
And David says, I'll bring 200.
David doesn't say anything. He goes out with his men, who's attracted to him, and they bring back the foreskins of 200 Philistines. In the meantime, Merab has been given in marriage to some Princeton boy, somebody who appeared from somewhere. And then it does say the amazing sentence, Michal, Saul's younger daughter, loved David. And as you say, she does help him escape. And then after many years of David in exile as a kind of a Robin Hood, and David after that battle in which Saul and Jonathan die, the strong man Abner comes to David and says, we want you to be king of both kingdoms, south and north. The first thing David says is, if you want me to talk to you about being king, first I want to see, if you want to see my face, he mentions his face, if you want to see my face in this matter, I want to see my wife, Michal, for whom I paid 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Doesn't mention the sort of tip or pourboire of the extra 100, walking toward me. She has a husband in the meantime. And she walks toward him, the husband walking after her, weeping, until the general Abner says to the husband, go home. Then she comes to David, and this great love then clearly has become a tremendously savage hatred on both sides, deeply intimate and very, very strong. It's an amazing story.
I'm speaking with Robert Pinsky. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. The book we're talking about is The Life of David, published by Schocken. We'll continue after this short break. Thank you. Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Robert Pinsky about the life of David. Now, as the story continues, which will include Bathsheba, the war between David and his son Absalom, even the woman who comforts him on his deathbed, Abishag. What we see, we would call it perhaps two-faced, at best ambiguous. But do you feel that this is what the Bible is teaching us about human character when successful?
I feel the presence of a great, great writer. And that great writer, especially in the second, what we call the second book of Samuel, is showing what a human life is. The life of David, in his way, the life. A human life may involve being a beautiful boy. It may mean accomplishing many things. But it's a blink of God's eye. It is very brief. And in the words of Ben Jonson, if no other misery, yet age. Human life does not end in glory. If we're lucky, it ends in peace and accomplishment and love, so that the glory passes. It is transitory. And David is a thrilling, thrilling character. He comes to fruition in every possible way. He does it all. He makes art. He governs. He has dozens of wives and concubines. And at the end, he is weak. And to the very end, he is rather nasty, too. His dying words are along the lines of, "That one was my enemy. I forgave," he says to Solomon. "I promised I wouldn't hurt. Don't let his gray head go down to Sheol unbloody."
Because it seemed to me, when we add the story of Jonathan and the probable homosexuality, or at least the strong suggestion,
love surpassing the love of women.
Exactly. That we're talking about a representative figure who was meant to be everything.
Yes.
And when we consider some of the Psalms of David, in particular those that are acrostically beginning with Aleph and going to the end of the alphabet, all of the metaphors suggest total inclusiveness, that every possibility of life, conquest and defeat, be a part of this figure who is, it seems, anointed by and approved of by the Lord as the King of Israel.
Yes. Life is full of many things, but it's not infinite. It's so abundant, and it's not in my favorite legend is the legend that David was not supposed to live beyond infancy. He was supposed to die as a little baby. But Adam happens to be walking around the part of heaven where the souls are waiting to be born. And Adam sees David's soul and he says, "Oh, this kid is great. Oh, that's a great, that's an amazing, that soul is wonderful." And God happens to be around, and Adam says to God, "You know, that is a great soul. He shouldn't die in infancy. Look, you gave me 1,000 years to live. I'll give 70 of my years to him." So God calls the lawyer angels. They draw up a contract. "The aforementioned Adam doth hereby assign in all rights pertaining to 70 years defined as blah, blah, to the above mentioned and foresigned." They sign the document. God witnesses it. And Adam gives 70 of his 1,000 years to David. This means the first man, who is the seed that contains all of us, any good or bad thing we are or could do, Adam is the seed. Everything is in him. We're all in him. David is recognized by Adam as the fruition, the flowering of all the things that we might be. And in both cases, it doesn't go on forever. It's finite.
This is in a midrash, yes? A variation.
Yeah.
Because as I was watching, my interpretation of your book was that it was an investigation of the many and the one. That is to say, at the beginning of the book, you parse out, who is David? Well, it seems that David as a descendant of Ruth, the Ruth of Ruth and Naomi, is in fact Moabite.
Yes.
And there's even a midrash that suggests that David's terrible behavior around rape and incest is forgiven because, in fact, he's not Jewish.
Sort of, and the sages at that point say, what can you do? What do you expect?
But
the Moabites, after all, are said by somebody to be descendants of Lot. Lot, whose daughters in that story get him drunk and lie with him. So this terrible slander or this awful thing is about the ancestry of Ruth and therefore of David.
So in a sense, at a time when the tribal rivalries are both intense, but the definition of who belongs to what tribe is kind of failing and loose, isn't it possible for someone to be first a Philistine henchman and then king of Israel, both not in camouflage, but both as actual practical realities of a life lived in a desert among tribes who have names for one another's gods that seem, in fact, to be doublings of the nature
yes.
of God?
They seem to understand one another's gods. They propitiate one another's gods. They forbid Astarte, and then in the person of Solomon, they worship Astarte, and Astarte or Ashtaroth seems to come back in some guise as Esther in the book of Esther, the only book of the Hebrew Bible that doesn't mention God, by the way. This is a much more multiple, much more shifting world than convention wants us to think of it as being. And it's a corrective to a sort of rigid sectarian view of the world. It says that the world is highly fungible and enigmatic and not easily divided into things. We each have millions of ancestors. Some of them are the same people over and over again. It gives David's, I mean, one thing that I have not figured out is why so many of David's strongest allies are non-Hebrews. They're not people of Israel. The Pharethites and Cherethites, I guess, sort of mercenaries, but in some memorable dialogue, the mercenaries turn out to also be very loyal to David. David almost represents that process of making a city, having a country, having a temple, which is a rather cosmopolitan process compared to every man to his tents, or compared to the prophet Samuel saying, I have to hack up Amalek into pieces because Amalek is the one who tormented Jacob.
Because, Robert, as I was reading the Bible, mostly after reading Thomas Mann's Joseph and His Brothers, and Mann's point is that all stories are versions of another story, mm-hmm. and that these two stories fuse and reflect each other in time so that time itself becomes bent. And I just wanted to go back and see at least a simpler chronology, which of course you won't find.
No, you can't make a chronology out of most of the biblical material.
But I did find things I didn't know, that, you know, conquered lands are to be returned to the conquered people after a certain period of time. I was reminded of things that broke my heart given the lives we live today, that what a teeth is that of everything you reap from the field, a tenth is left at the margin of the field for the poor.
Yes.
That what we expect to find, which is the origin of rigid sects and warfare, we find strangely mollified, and David seems to act simultaneously as a figure of aggression and contrition, of selection, and a boy with simple talent from nowhere who didn't need to be selected, almost as if what we're being told is that the human nature requires infinite shift and infinite accommodation.
I think that's true. If I am not a student of anthropology, but if you classified folk tales, basic tales, take those stories that Mann says are always versions of other stories, this David is the youngest son. And in many fairy tales, myths, legend, after the older daughters or brothers fail to meet some test or are deceived by some evil character or don't manage to conquer, the younger one manages it. And I would speculate that that figure of the younger changing it has to do with that need to accommodate, to change. Their first instinct is first and bigger is best. And the stories are always saying, but sometimes we have to abandon what looks like the right order of things and upset it and let the runt or the underdog come up and say, no, there's a different way to do it. It's almost in a kind of evolutionary sense necessary for the clever, almost hairless little monkey that accept that sometimes everything must change. Everything must be seen in a new way.
He's a naked dancer.
Yes.
You say again and again, he's lithe and limber. It surely is the first time that a non-swarthy, non-huge shapeshifter is allowed to have a kingship that alters time and destiny.
The other people look more like a king. He looks like the king's quickest guy. And he is quick physically and mentally. You can sympathize with Saul. Saul doesn't just want to kill him. Saul wants to throw a spear at him and pin him to the wall because he is so fast and he changes so adeptly.
I've been speaking with Robert Pinsky, author most recently of The Life of David, published by Schocken. Thank you, Robert, for joining me.
Real pleasure to talk to you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.